Fox Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Good morning. Welcome to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Friday. It's finally Friday. It's the Friday before, I guess, any meaningful football season. And it's just barely meaningful, guys, I suppose. Maybe LSU, Florida State, everything else kind of a formality or a symbolic start to the season. So we'll see how that goes. But that's coming up tomorrow for those of you looking toward the calendar. Coming up on today's calendar on the program from Alabama Daily News, Todd Stacey. Always good to talk to him. We do him get him on every week. In the 10 o'clock hour, a guy named David Randall. He's from the National Association of Scholars, part of the Civics Alliance. And he had a reaction to a Claremont Institute report about the University of Alabama and Auburn University. Woke in Dixie is headline of the report was, but what does Alabama need to do to get out of this rut of DEI? It's like they're held captive by DEI policy, and these are in part your tax dollars, but this is not how it's supposed to be in Alabama. We're supposed to be a red state, a sanctuary from the crazy. But it turns out the sanctuary from the crazy has its own crazy problems and our flagship universities. And we're going to talk to Mr. Randall about that at 10 o'clock hour. Dave Bowery, on from time to time. What happens usually is I ask Dave to come on and we spend the first 10 minutes talking about football or something completely not pertinent to politics. But David is he's a political consultant. There's a little lobbying on the side, but we'll talk about what I think. I think, guys, and everyone tells me I'm crazy, that Jerry Carl and Barry Moore are about to be in the same congressional district. And here it is. It's Friday, and the 11th Circuit still has not put out any kind of decision, at least as far as I could tell, regarding redistricting. More on that in a moment. We'll talk to that. It's also the very interesting come across the wire about that. Finally, our returning champion, we do this every Friday, State Senator Chris Elliott. Busy week in Baldwin County, at least in his district. So we'll hear from him. Well, yeah, I guess last week was probably the busy week, the end of the week, but the fallout continues. I hear your attorney Kennan earlier this week on the program talking about John Cooper, the bridge, if you don't like the hike in the toll. Call the governor is what he said. A governor yesterday in Birmingham, or Hoover to be precise, announcing a few new projects, a $300 million. These projects were already out there. I don't really know what's going on. Well, I kind of have my suspicions. So, essentially, Governor Ivey appeared at the municipal complex in Hoover yesterday, announced three new road projects for Birmingham. Congratulations, Birmingham. Another $500 million going to Birmingham. But they were projects we already knew about. We already knew about the widening of 65, that six-mile stretch, a very busy stretch between Alabaster and Calera. Six lanes ought to get them all the way down to the Shelby County line, or at least really close. Trustwheel getting some help there on I-59, and then another overpass on 459 near Birmingham. But anyway, what do you need to know? What does this matter to you guys? It does because I think it's it's Governor Ivey responding to Will Ainsworth and his criticism, because they're worried about the West Alabama corridor being on the ropes. This West Alabama corridor, like I told you guys, it is Governor Ivey's legacy project, and what's remarkable about that is It's having to borrow against perhaps 20 years worth of gas tax revenue. And I think it's on the ropes. We'll see. We'll see where it goes. They're not going to get this thing built in 3 years. Or maybe they will. I don't know. But it's trying to be fast-tracked. On the other hand, John Cooper, our esteemed ALDOT director, was not at this big highway announcement yesterday. He's in hiding or in the witness protection program, it appears. Anyway, so that's where we are as far as new road projects go. And I mentioned this earlier, guys, with another reason I think this Barrymore Jerry Carl thing could happen. Now, Barrymore announcing a fundraiser, a high-profile name doing a fundraiser for him, Jim Jordan. Y'all know Jim Jordan. He's the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. And, you know, typically you don't pull out the – I would say Jim Jordan's a big gun. But the fundraiser in Montgomery on October 1st, he says, Jordan says, quote, "We need battle-tested conservatives like Barrymore in the House in order to win the fight against the radical left and restore our justice system. Barry has proven to be instrumental in our effort to ensure that the federal government works for the American people, not against them." So what's that? October 1st will be a Sunday fundraiser up in Montgomery with Jim Jordan and Barry Moore. So Congressman Moore, if he's not gearing up for a head-to-head against Jerry Carl, he's gearing up for a head-to-head against Stephen Reed. And we're already, it's 2024 time. You better get ready. Barrymore's always had a target on him. He just doesn't really fit. I mean, he got by for those first two terms because there was Mo Brooks. But typically, the second congressional district, I mean, they just want that member to be the ag guy, the one working their way up in agriculture. When I say they, the powers that be in Alabama politics, and Barrymore does a little of that, but I don't think he's their ideal guy. When BCA does their endorsements, they endorsed every member of Congress except for Barrymore. They even endorsed Terry Sewell, the Democrat, liberal Democrat, I might add. Maybe they endorsed him this time around. We'll see. I noticed he was out and about there in Point Clear recently. David Cole, this is great. Some of you hate listeners out there, why don't you talk about a Republican committed election fraud? So they represent David Cole, formerly of Madison, and now has pled guilty. 60 days in jail, 3 years of unsupervised probation. 60 days in jail for, I guess, leasing an apartment, claiming that is your home, registering to vote there, and never really spending much time there. 60 days in jail seems pretty steep, but he has restitution, he has to repay a salary. Problem is, I guess, it becomes a taxpayer burden because Governor Ives got to call a special election. I really think Democrats could pick one up here. They almost did during the last election cycle, but somehow this guy doesn't live in the district, just barely held on. Also, speaking of lawmakers, John Rogers has been in the legislature forever. His assistant was indicted yesterday. John Rogers, a Birmingham lawmaker, but a Democrat lawmaker, indicted for fraud, money laundering. They were trying to take, she was $200,000 in money, of public money. And it was going to go toward a baseball program. Fred Plump, Coach Plump, was in charge of. It's funny, the media in Alabama downplaying this. John Rogers, hardline Democrat, always a guy to get up there and protest everything Republicans do. His assistant indicted in federal court, Northern District of Alabama. And hardly a peep out of the media in the state. Have y'all heard about it much? I guarantee if it were a Republican member, it would be make every Mobile news channel. But it hasn't. Not yet. Maybe it's a wait and see. Two five one three four three zero one zero six. Get me up on the text line. I mean, I know what you're thinking. We are heading into the Labor Day weekend. Things are kind of winding down, but still a lot of speculation about Donald Trump's legal woes. The green lit cameras in the courtroom. They will not be able to get enough of this. It's like OJ and Donald Trump. It's like OJ and politics, presidential politics, all in one. I'm predicting we'll get big ratings. I mean, it's going to be... You see cable news get really huge late ratings with this federal, I mean, this Fulton County court case. If it gets that far, I'm still not convinced it's going to get that far. And we don't know for sure what it's going to be. Should Donald Trump be able to have his court case delayed because he's running for president? Should he? Because of the accusation of election interference. This is such a subjective call here. When you know, if Jeff Poore decided he was going to run for president and he goes out and commits accused of committing a federal, I don't think Trump really committed a crime here. Would I be able to put my court proceedings postponed until post-election? You got to try to make the case. I think, though, that the prosecution is going to be careful here, but, I mean, it's not unheard of when you bring a case that's just totally flawed and have some kind of, and it'll say they eventually he's acquitted and they have some kind of retribution, like Mike Nifong and Duke LaCrosse. 251-343-0106. We'll get to more here in a moment. This is the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Not knowing where I'm bound, and no one can change my mind, but Mama tried. Get on me, want to know, Hank, why do you drink?
Welcome back to the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for sticking around on this Friday morning. 251-343-0106. That's how you get in touch with the program. So to come on the program in the next segment from Alabama Daily News, Todd Stacy, our Friday, one of our Friday regulars, will be with us. We'll talk about the Ivy announcement yesterday. What is holding up the 11th Circuit? And I don't know what else. Whatever else is out there. Like I said, interested in the future of our congressional districts because it's going to change the entire state, especially if we had two purple districts for decades. But demographics are always shifting. Look, you used to have in Alabama in 1990 more Democrats. The state was not completely solidly red yet. It was still kind of, you know, after the Civil War, and the Republicans. After the Civil War and Lincoln being a Republican, and then Reconstruction with all the Republicans who carpetbagged into the South, it made Alabama, made the South solidly Democrat for more than a century, and then finally Reagan in 80. Some people can say Goldwater in the 60s, but Reagan in 80, and then the trend also continued for the next 30 years all the way to 2010. And now it's finally solidly red here in 2023. Let's go to the text line. Let's see what we got here. We got the problem with the text, sometimes you got to look and make sure they're not meant for the previous show. King of all named textures, Ive Legacy takes a gamble on attracting more businesses instead of working. Oh, Ivy's Legacy. I think we had a misspelling or mistyping there. Ivy's Legacy takes a gamble at attracting more business instead of working down Alabama's current and longstanding infrastructure problems. If you want to boil everything down to a complaint for me, it's just this, the policy, everything seems to center around, and I'm so tired, it's so cliche, but what do the big mules want? And everything is like ran through that filter. And if it doesn't matter to them, it gets through. Or if it needs to be tweaked to appease them, that's to where it goes. Or sometimes it doesn't make it through at all. ESG. All of that. And these economic incentives. The deepening and widening of the Port of Mobile, which is a valid and a very important infrastructure project, but should it be put at the top of the list of everything else? And like a state lawmaker will come on and give me a list of like, how great this is for us. But you know what I want? I want to be able to get across the bay back and forth before you widen the port, but that's, maybe, am I the only one here that thinks this? I would like not to have to sit to get through the Wallace Tunnel in the summertime. Could we do that before we wind up? No, we got to get the port done first. What are you, crazy? All that stuff from China's got to come somewhere. But that's what it is. It's just everything is, those guys are put at the front of the line. It's like the game plan last year with the incentives. That's what they wanted. That's what they get. The only problem is the business community right now is not, it's not exactly a Tea Party right of center. It's going woke. And it's even touching here in Alabama. Damn Yankee writes, you just mentioned Meemaw K, Al Dot. And the words fast track at the same time. What were you thinking? Is that like a Beetlejuice scenario? You combine all these words and something happens? Sad Troll writes, as someone who works at the port, widening it will bring millions to the state. I don't care. I there's a quality of life that benefits more people, things that they can do. And it should not be a priority over everything else. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Moore Show on FM Talk 106.5. Put on the pedal. Some have a mind in brakes. Let it all hang out because we got to run to make. Have a Welcome back to the Jeff Moore Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for sticking around on this Friday morning. 251-343-0106. You want to be in touch with the program. Utilize the text line, and I will do my best to respond to whatever you have on your mind. Still to come on the program, jam-packed show. David Randall from the National Association of Scholars has a piece out in the Federalist about the University of Alabama. Also, a political consultant, Dave Maurer, good friend of the program. And we wrap it all up with State Senator Chris Elliott, our returning champion. What a way to close out the week. So that's coming up throughout the remainder of today's program. But join us now, another Friday regular, always good to hear from. He's the host of Capital Journal and also the publisher of Alabama Daily News. Todd Stacey on with us. Todd, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great, Jeff. How are you?
Doing well. Well, here it is. It is 9:35 on September 1st. And are you surprised we still haven't heard from the 11th Circuit on the redistricting?
Well, there's still time. I was, kind of thinking it would be this week or next. So, typically they get those kind of things out by noon. So maybe we've got a little while. I tell you, it would be nice if they went ahead and ruled, because then the rest of the steps could be taken, right? We expect them to reject what the legislature has done. The attorney general will appeal that, and this begins the process of seeing if that Supreme Court might think differently about how this map is drawn, Kavanaugh specifically. It would just be nice for everybody involved if that process started sooner rather than later, so we know, what these districts are going to actually look like.
Well, do you read anything into it that it wasn't just immediately rejected by this three-judge panel, that it's taken this much time? Because that was the speculation, right? Did everybody's expecting the three-judge panel to say no? And here it is. I mean, they didn't. They're still deliberating, or they're still working out some issues, it appears.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could read into that to say maybe they're taking their time and really diving into what the map actually does and what it doesn't do. But I mean, just based on their questions during that hearing back in August, a few weeks ago, it just didn't seem like they were on the same page. And the attorney general's arguments, the state's arguments, really seemed more aimed toward the Supreme Court, right? Like they were just expecting it. And so maybe we'll see. I mean, obviously that would be a huge win for the legislature. It would also be a huge win for the congressional delegation if the map went forward, if it was just accepted by this three-judge panel. A lot of people would be happy about that. And it would have pretty big implications nationwide. I mean, you would kind of have this dual track. You'd have, okay, the Supreme Court said no to this map, and yet a lower court has said yes to a marginally better map. So how does that work out across the country, right? That would mean a lot of these redistricting decisions would be, pretty messy going forward. So we'll see. I mean, I guess it doesn't do me any good to predict anything, but yeah, I expect them to reject it.
Yeah, I think that seems to be the universal conventional wisdom right now. So we'll see. But I agree with you there. Yesterday, Kay Ivey's announcement in Birmingham. I think we knew about these three projects kind of mostly already, but when the governor puts the rebuild sign out and makes an appearance, she's just, I think, trying to make sure that people are aware that there is something going on, I guess.
Yeah, which is important. I mean, if they just kind of started work, I mean, everybody would appreciate it. But I mean, in this day and age, you need to get out there and let people know, hey, look, this is what the state is doing, not just to make them aware of, where traffic's going to be, But, you know, let's not forget, you know, back in 2019, she proposed and the legislature passed a tax, a gas tax increase and infrastructure plan. So, yeah, if you do that, you better be out there saying exactly what that money is going to, you know, be used for. Yeah, obviously Birmingham is a very congested area. Everybody's happy to see that whole 65 stretch. I think it's 12 miles south of Alabaster, which is really like the worst of the worst. I mean, it's not going to fix every problem. I was thinking to myself, all right, you got to keep going south. You know, get to Clanton, get to Prattville, and then you really can solve that problem. But I also was looking at the amounts. I mean, 12 miles, right, from Alabaster to Calera. We all know that stretch. We've all been on it in the summer, especially. It can be just maddening. But just that 12 miles costs $300 million. So that, to me, puts in perspective just how expensive it is to widen an interstate, you know, all the different bridges that have to go over, railroads and all that kind of stuff. $300 million. So when you think about, like you said, going south to Prattville, or, you know, even further down to the coast, that's a lot of money. I think it's important that those figures are out there so that we all understand, all right, we're talking about billions of dollars to really fix 65.
Yeah, that was an eye-popping number for that. I mean, it's not even 12 miles. It's like 8 miles or something, but it's from the Alabaster exit to that first Calera exit. And then you take that and you figure out what it is per mile. I mean, it's not going to be cheap to fulfill Will Ainsworth's vision for Interstate 65 at all.
Right. I asked him about that down at BCA. Because, I mean, look, I'm with him. Like, let's widen the, you know, 65, the whole thing. I mean, I don't have any delusion that we're going to widen the 65 bridge to Mobile, right? That's a whole different thing.
Right.
But yeah, the whole thing needs to be widened. But, and I was asking, how do we pay for this? Do we have enough tax base? And he was confident that we did. Of course, he goes back to the whole Highway 43 project and what money can be leveraged. But yeah, when you think about $300 million just to pave, let's put it at 10, you know, 10 miles of interstate. And look, you're dealing with things like inflation, supply chain. I get it. It's probably more expensive than it should be or used to be, but that's pretty expensive. And so, you know, until we have a solution, you know, to how to pay for it, and, you know, we've already raised the gas tax, then, yeah, it remains an incremental project.
Joined by Todd Stacey, Alabama Daily News, Capital Journal, here on the program. Todd, the Medical Cannabis Commission, maybe I was naive to think this would go better. Probably shouldn't have been that naive, but, I mean, it turns out reinventing the wheel is a very difficult process, it seems. But the fact that it's had this many hurdles to overcome, was this anticipated? I knew it wasn't going to be easy, but it seems like a very frustrating process for all involved.
It is, and I'll put it this way, and I've spent a lot of time talking with folks involved from the commission standpoint, from the industry standpoint, you know, as many as you can think of, and I'll put it this way. Even if everything had gone perfectly, meaning no, you know, foul up on the scores, right, the scoring thing, no questions about Open Meetings Act and stuff like that, secrecy meetings, nothing like that. Even if there were no problems of any kind, you would still have lawsuits. You would still have companies that missed out on these licenses suing and raising hell to try to get in the process, to try to get a license, because you're talking about millions of dollars. This is a huge, huge business. It's only going to get bigger. And so even if everything went perfectly, you'd still have it. So the fact that you did have the screw up on the scores, right? That was That was a problem. I mean, it's like one person, and it sort of got compounded. But there you go. And that just sort of threw fuel onto this fire. So it's a little bit of both. I mean, you've got an imperfect process. You've got an imperfect law. I mean, you go back to 2021 when they passed this law. They were very intentional about limiting how many companies could be involved, how many stores, you know, could be dispensing medical marijuana. They wanted to limit its impact. They were talking about, we don't want a store on every corner, that kind of thing. Well, what you get out of that is a lot of competition. And from some pretty big companies and some pretty big players in politics that aren't going to go quietly. So it's a little bit of both. It was always going to be tough. There was always going to be litigation, but the whole scoring screw up really made that a lot worse and kind of gave fuel to that fire.
I mean, I'm pretty plugged in. I just don't, it's so complicated, right? It seems way more complicated than it needs to be. And I really had to like dive into this deep to understand what the complaints are, why, what part of the process we're in. And this is, this just seems to be kind of a thing typically in government, but, this one is really, really, I think complex.
It is, and I think if they could do it over again, the commission would make some different choices. There's a reason why you go and contract with some, you know, national firm or some really well-respected firm. Number one, it gives you sort of distance to say, well, look, this is PricewaterhouseCooper, you know, this is Deloitte. They are the experts in this, and or just to find somebody that's done it before and really just rely on them. Instead of, like you said, reinventing the wheel. And I'll say this, looking at other states, pretty much every state has had a rocky rollout of their medical marijuana program. The one thing that could make it a lot simpler is the declassification of marijuana as a, you know, schedule whatever drug. That's really the complication because it's, you know, all the specialty, and who knows, that might happen. But we're kind of tired of covering it because you get so many players in here. But I think ultimately, and I wrote about this a little bit on Inside Alabama Politics, I think ultimately the end of the story is there's going to be legislation. They're going to open back up the law. The easiest way to do this is to expand the number of licenses. Every company that is right now fighting in court has a lobbyist that is plugged in, well connected, and I absolutely expect them to push for revisions to the law that allow more companies in.
Last question, Todd, before we get you out of here. David Cole, that old Mike Ball seat now up for grabs is going to be again. I think Democrats. Now that, you know, don't underestimate the Alabama Democratic Party to blow an opportunity here, but I think they can win that seat and pick up a seat. I mean, not that it would matter in the big scheme of things, but at least they would be moving in a direction here. But I think that seat is certainly one Democrats can win if there's a special election called by the governor.
Well, remember going into 2022, everybody thought that was, if there were going to be competitive races, that was right at the top of the list, right? We thought that might be competitive with Democrats. Turned out it really wasn't. I mean, but yeah, it should be. It's drawn to be at least a little bit purple. So we'll see. I mean, to me, it's all about who gets nominated. If you have a Democrat that can appeal to, that is a true moderate, that can appeal to the middle, that's one thing. But these days, that really doesn't happen a lot. They tend to nominate, lefties that really get their base fired up, but the Republicans are determined to defeat. So we'll see. And these days, it's just, even if you're, R+2, R+1, it's still hard for Democrats just because you know, even if you're a moderate Democrat that, you know, really shares a lot of the same values as Republicans, having that Democrat, you know, D by your name just makes you unacceptable to
right.
almost all Republicans. And that's just the way it is.
Well, I mean, there's no, if it's on a ballot by itself, it'll be low turnout and there won't be anything, there won't be anybody's coattails to ride. And I think that area, you know, I was up there for a year and a half. I think the changes in that area are shifting. It's certainly more purple than it was 20 years ago. It's a totally different place. Like I said, the Democrats don't blow it. They could pick one off there, but I think this is the best shot they're going to have if they got one. This is a much better shot than they will have in 26 for sure.
Well, yeah, and don't forget they have the ability to say, you know, this the guy that you just elected is going to jail for voter fraud, right? For corruption, whatever you want to, however you want to call it. You can really message that, and so. You nominate the right candidate, absolutely, but you're also right at the beginning of this question that Democrats have just zero infrastructure, disorganization, disarray at the top of the party, the state party. So, I mean, as good as, you know, a guy like Anthony Daniels is, he's got to deal with Joe Reed and the non-existent infrastructure, the dysfunction of the Alabama Democratic Party. So the cavalry is not really coming for them.
Well said. Todd, before I let you go, folks want to sign up for your newsletter and they want to know what to expect on Capital Journal. Tell them what they need to know.
That's right. Capital Journal is tonight at 7:30 on Alabama Public Television. We'll be talking to House Speaker Nathaniel Ledbetter. We actually get into the David Cole situation and other issues. State Superintendent Eric Mackey about the start of school and a lot of issues going on there. And Chris Isaacson with the Alabama Forestry Association. That's some really cool things forestry is doing. So, yeah, please tune in at 7:30 tonight. And you can always sign up for the Alabama Daily News email. It's really easy. Just go to aldailynews.com, put your name and your email there on the front page, and you'll be on the list.
Todd, War Eagle, and we'll do this all again next week.
All right, man. War Eagle.
All right. We got to get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Moore Show on FM Talk 106.5. To the Jeff Moore Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you for being with us on this Friday. I've told my son he likes to sit in the back of my Jeep and yell, play some Freebird. Now he has adopted Freebird as his anthem, which has recently replaced Wheels on the Bus as our drive time music on the way to what we call big kids school. So raising them right there. 251-343-0106. Text me. Let's see. Jeff, $300 a barrel oil coming quick. Okay, our dollar is in trouble. The economy is dead. We're coming for a crash warning. Beg you, Jeff. There's a collapsing everything. We don't wake up and turn to God, the Lord Jesus, Christ America will burn. Ricky, doesn't this seem like oil and the economy are worldly concerns? And I'm no theologian, but I'm gonna put this out there for you. And then, you know, the eternity goes beyond what the dollar is, how the dollar's performing against commodities. But, you know, like I'm all about praying and begging for salvation. But it seems like your concerns that they're of this world. And your focus ought to be beyond, right? So just throwing that out there for you, Ricky. But we always appreciate the feedback. We certainly do. Y'all see this? This is kind of a interesting dust up between Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, and Steve Marshall, the attorney general. I think Sean talked about this some yesterday. But the idea that you could enforce Alabama state law beyond the boundaries a discussion. And we'll get you more into that in the coming segments. Stay tuned. This is the Jeff Moore Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Don't it make my brown eyes? Don't it make my brown eyes blue?
From Buck's Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way. No.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for staying with us on this Friday morning. Friday, before we get into the Labor Day weekend, Ascension Technologies text line 251-343-0106. Need a comment, complaint, compliment, whatever's on your mind. Hit me up on that text line, and I'll do my best to respond. Still to come on the program about a half hour from now. Dave Bauer, he's a political consultant, Montgomery-based. I need his thoughts on the redistricting stuff and kind of where that's going to – that could shape Alabama's political lineup in a just really shake it up in a significant way. But we'll talk to Dave about that. Then in the 11 o'clock hour, State Senator Chris Elliott, our returning champion. We talk to him every Friday at the bottom of the hour and at 11 o'clock hour, so you want to stay tuned for that. Joining us now on the line, my next guest, he is with the National Association of Scholars, part of Civics Alliance, but it's a very important piece at the Federalist. I encourage everybody to go check it out. Headlined, the University of Alabama Dean, Identity Politics is the whole purpose of the university, that coming out of a Claremont study done by Scott Nooner earlier. We talked a little bit about that, going woke in Dixie, and as it turns out, we're not immune in Alabama to any of this DEI nonsense. But joining us on the line now is David Randall. David, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you so much for having me on.
Hey, thanks for making time for us. Well, kind of walk us through this. You've obviously studied this. This is a problem at a lot of institutions of higher learnings around the country. Obviously, we talk about it all the time. But as it turns out, even politically ruby red, right of center Alabama, not immune to this. And there's some measures, there's some corrective actions or some kind of measures need to be taken in this, with these circumstances.
Yes, and this is what Scott Yenner's report is wonderful at, you know, going woke in Dixie. I've written a national report, Social Justice Education in America. It outlines the format of this vast social justice DEI machine that's been taking over the universities for a generation and more. And, you know, there is a national professional culture that takes over every higher education administration, the professoriate. But every state, the citizens ought to, yeah, have a good report saying, yes, it's happening here too. Scott Yenner did a wonderful job pointing out, yes, here it is in Alabama, same as everywhere else. And I should say, and then my article also includes, and what are some solutions, including in particular some model legislation from the Civics Alliance, which we think would do a good job at getting rid of DEI from the universities.
Now, you also talk about some of the proposals out there to legislatures considering the divisive concepts bill. You say it's a good first step, but it maybe there's more that needs to be done beyond what the legislature's trying to do.
Yeah, that is divisive concepts. It is wonderful, but first, you know, you have to change the mission statement because accreditors will force a university to put in DEI programming if they put in like one little apparently innocuous commitment to diversity in the mission statement. You got to have budget transparency and a line item veto on university budgets. You've got to make sure that the admissions requirements aren't being used to require DEI, CRT in the high school. You got to have a whole range of freedoms guaranteed. The First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of association, due process, intellectual diversity, non-discrimination by race, require the universities to classify students by sex rather than by subjective and arbitrary gender. And then enforcement, transparency and enforcement, where you've got to assume that the university administrations are going to be non-compliant or malfeasant for any law. You've got to make sure that there's a way to report what's going on directly to the state policymakers and make sure there are consequences for breaking the laws.
And that's been the problem historically with these types of measures, that like that these are boogeymen, ESG, DEI, et cetera, that have to be slayed, but the legislature will put up a lot of bills and they'll pass. I mean, it's not too surprising in a Republican supermajority these things are done, but there's no enforcement mechanism. And that's where the devil's in the details, is making sure that something has teeth in it that can really maybe kind of put the brakes on this trend.
You need the enforcement, and you just need individual politicians who really make this a priority, whether it be a governor, a secretary of education, an attorney general, or state senators and state representatives, making sure that various university presidents are brought before a committee to testify, being prepared to ask them acute questions, following up. It's never going to be self-executing. You should set up the machinery for enforcement, but you need politicians to stand up, pay attention, and continue paying attention year after year.
Well, tell me something, David. Now, that Supreme Court ruling earlier this summer about affirmative action, these race-based admission standards, and putting an end to that, what has that done to the whole DEI movement within higher ed? Because I would think that a lot of what the DEI establishment, or whatever you want to call it, within universities is, has to deal with that. And now that's really not it's ruled unconstitutional. Has that changed anything?
Only if we continue to apply pressure. Every university has announced, in effect, or virtually every university, their intent to defy in substance that ruling. Some of them are even thumbing their nose at the court by using the exact wording of the ruling to like include like as part of an essay prompt, which is meant obviously to provide a way to continue unconstitutional affirmative action. There has to be a concerted campaign, again, by citizens, policymakers, to make sure that the universities follow in detail the principles laid out by the court. Otherwise, it will be a ruling with no effect.
Well, and I know this is wishful thinking and maybe pie in the sky, but the Department of Justice, if schools just thumb their nose at this ruling and defy it, is this like a, could this be a civil rights violation? I mean, could this be something, just in theory, I know that that's a left-leaning agency right now, and we can have another discussion about the deep state and all the institutional biases within it, but whatever. But doesn't this make these universities vulnerable to some kind of federal action taken against them if they just thumb their nose at the high court?
With a friendly administration, with a sympathetic Justice Department, possibly. But in effect, all of DEI is unconstitutionally violating the civil rights of Americans. I mean, prima facie, there's just been an agreement to look it over. There are deep-rooted reforms you need to do, including getting rid of disparate impact doctrine and which is used in effect to say everybody is guilty of civil rights discrimination, and therefore, so long as you have disparate impact, everything the country does is illegal and subject to the administrative state.
Joined by David Randall here on the program as a important piece up at the Federalist, kind of talking about the recent Claremont Institute about the University of Alabama, Auburn University, and just how the trend is not, we're not immune to that here with the trend of the growth of the, these DEI policies. Something, we had another gentleman on a couple months ago, a former professor, a history professor from the University of Alabama, and he really takes issue with this, but I assume this is kind of the trend nationally that the DEI department or whatever it is at the University of Alabama is now twice the size of the, at least as of personnel that they have within the Department of History. And that just kind of tells you, that's like symbolic of everything you need to know about the direction, the trend within these schools. I mean, this isn't just like four or five people with a crazy view of the world, that it's really consuming the administrations at these schools.
And the DEI bureaucrats are beginning to become the presidents of the university. I believe University of California, San Diego is the first one where a president is directly coming out of the DEI bureaucracy. That's going to be happening more and more. And yes, it's this vast idea, political commissariat enforcing political correctness, not just the centrally funded DEI offices, but DEI officers within each department, DEI committees, comprised of professors and students. They are replicating the political police in every level of university administration.
What does it look like? Let's say this trend continues. What is the ultimate goal of these guys? I mean, obviously, the academy's always been left-leaning, and it's a place where they sing the virtues of, like, Karl Marx or whatever. It's just, you know, it's always been that way. But, I mean, what is the evil? What are the consequences to doing nothing here?
You lose control of all of civil society, because universities' accreditation and licensure will all be subject to political requirements. Alabama law requires the National Social Workers Association, I believe it is, which licenses social workers, as a requirement for a social worker alliance licensure. Social work licensure now has incredibly radical DEI statement embedded in it. You cannot become a social worker in Alabama without subscribing to being indoctrinated by DEI ideology. But this matter is even more importantly, with no offense to social workers, to medicines and above all lawyers. Once all legal licensure requires DEI propaganda, the entire legal system loses any ability for anybody who opposes DEI to even represent you, much less become a judge.
And that's, like you said, all these things are like the underpinnings of our civil society. And once you start contaminating them with all this DEI stuff and that mindset, the whole system sort of collapses.
Yeah, but in effect, it does mean only DEI believers or people who are willing to compromise their consciousness will be able to get any professional job. And then in the long run, of course, our competition as a great power with China collapses because, we won't be able to do physics research, much less turn on the lights when everybody is hired based upon loyalty to a political program.
Well, last question we'll get you out of here on this, though. I mean, a lot of this, I think, is being kind of steered by the federal government or outside the boundaries of the state. If you want to be eligible for federal dollars, or if it's like, money from some nonprofit out in California or whatever, then you need to have a lot of this in place. How do you defend against that? I mean, the federal government, all these schools depend on federal dollars, and the sort of social engineering going on at that level, I think, is dictating the terms here a lot of times.
Very much so, which is why a federal, federal political initiative is desperately needed. I will also say part of this is going through the accreditors, which are a weird semi-autonomous organization between the federal government and the states. One thing that can be done by the states is accreditation reform and the appointment of alternate accreditors, which they now have the right, you know, regional accreditors, such as the American Association for Liberal Education, I believe, would be a brilliant alternate accreditor to substitute for undergraduate accreditation. But there's also require the public universities not to assent to woke accreditation standards within their members of them. When university presidents say they have to do what accreditors tell them to do for federal dollars, they're the ones voting for the standards. So even though there is great federal control and an absolute vital need to work on it, the states can assert control of their public universities by a considered, deliberate, prudent, and effective policy of accreditation reform.
David, folks want to find you online. They want to check out your Federalist piece or any of that. Tell them how they could do so.
Sorry, tell them how to get to the Federalist piece. Did you say?
Aren't they want to check you out? They want to find your social media or anything else you're working on. How can they do so?
www.nas.nas.org for the National Association of Scholars. Also look out civicsalliance.org for the Civics Alliance, which focuses on K-12 education. And, you know, for more stuff by other good folks, Scott Yenner and the Claremont Institute, just Google their names and see what they're doing.
David, we appreciate your time. Let's talk again soon.
Lovely. Thank you so much.
All right. We got to get a break here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Moore Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Sitting here at the Floribama, about to open up a big old can. Good times. Unwind. Falling out of love in the same dollar. Can't say I got a...
Welcome back to the Jeff Moore Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for sticking around on this Friday. It's finally Friday. 251-343-0106. Need to be in touch with the program. Utilize the text line. Still to come. Dave Mallory in the next segment. Dave, a very, let's say, rabid supporter of the University of Georgia football effort there, which has been successful in the recent years, I understand. Perhaps we'll talk football with Dave as well, but still awaiting what the 11th Circuit's going to do and how they're going to draw or what they're going to draw or what they're going to do. Maybe they'll draw anything. Maybe they just say, here, you're getting these maps or you're getting the ones the legislature had. Probably not, though. Still waiting for that. Still waiting to determine if how that's going to shape Alabama politics for the future. But like I said, I'm somewhat surprised we haven't heard it by now. But as Todd Stacey pointed out earlier in the program, that, you know, could be around lunchtime, an afternoon news dump heading into the Labor Day weekend is something that's not totally unprecedented. And you get the big court decision wrapped up. You let the outrage sort of simmer down either way over the holiday weekend, and then everything starts fresh on Tuesday. So, by the way, programming note, no live show on Monday. I understand the morning show will be on, but Sean and I will be doing whatever aging Gen Xers do on their Labor Day weekends. I'm very eager to experience a Labor Day weekend in this demographic. So, no show on Monday. We'll pick it back up on Tuesday, like you said, hopefully with some clarity about what's going on in our politics. And that means maybe potentially no Dell Jackson. You'll have to wait a week. So anyway, enough of that. The other things, the news still seems to be all about Trump's legal woes and the Fulton County DA or the Fulton County judge there is going to allow cameras in the courtroom. So get ready. It's going to be very O.J. Simpson-esque. Those of you old enough to remember the blow-by-blow of the O.J. Simpson trial and just living through that. And that was like, that consumed my entire freshman year of Auburn, I remember, because it was like right before I went was the car chase and then and everything that came out of that. Then the trial was that next summer. But Donald Trump, still news. Also, we can talk more about this later in the program. DeSantis, is there still any hope DeSantis could be the nominee? And maybe there is. We'll explore that possibility later in the program. Let's get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Moore Show on FM Talk 106.5.
I may simply be a single drop of rain, but I will.
Inside my head, before I reached 30, I'd be dead. But somehow on and on I go.
Welcome back to the Jeff Moore Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for staying with us on this Friday, this get out of town or whatever it is you're going to do on your Labor Day weekend eve. But we do appreciate you listening. Text line 251-343-0106. Want to be in touch with the program, text me and I will text, or not text you, but I will respond to you at some point during the program if possible. Still to come in about an hour from now, our returning champion, State Senator Chris Elliott. A lot going on in Baldwin County, at least at the state level, so it ought to be a good segment. That's coming up in the next hour. Please stay tuned for that. But joining us now, one of my favorite guests, We are usually scheduled to talk about politics, but we wind up talking about football. Dave Mallory joins us. Dave, good morning. How are you?
Morning, Jeff. What's going on, bud?
Not much, man. You are right now, I guess, since I kind of teased it that way, another dominating year for the Georgia Bulldogs, it looks like.
Well, you know, like you said earlier, we are not I am not among the you know, members of our fan base who immediately started acting like, you said, Alabama fans, you know, or we're going to win everything. I think the schedule looks favorable. But, you know, it's different because, you know, 2 years ago we had Clemson in Charlotte. And then last year we had Oregon in the Mercedes-Benz Dome in Atlanta. And now we have UT Martin at home. And the September schedule leaves a lot to be desired, except for we have a rare late September fifth game in September with Auburn, September 30th, which is interesting. And you know, I kind of really, you know, my thing, I have no expectations. You know, I mean, we have the talent, but who knows, you know, who knows what the, you know, the, I don't know what the slings and arrows of 22-year-olds or 18-year-olds is going to do to us, you know?
Well, let me ask you something about this, and then we'll move on. Though, just you look at the changing lineup of the SEC. Do you ever think about it? Like, you know, what if they add a Florida State or Clemson or whatever it may be, and these regional rivalries? At least for a school like Georgia, and I don't think Georgia Tech would be in the mix or not. But I mean, you know, like, well, what does that do to that rivalry? If you keep expanding the conference, what does that do to a program like the University of Georgia if the SEC continues to go in this direction?
Well, one thing that it did is this year, it means that we don't have a game in Norman, Oklahoma, because that was supposed to be our second game. And so it did sort of set us up with some people might term a kind of cupcake schedule at the early part of the season, because we had to, you know, by the time that they canceled it, we had to have an FCS opponent. So I think we played Ball State next weekend. But to your question, you know, the interesting thing to me is like, take Florida State, right? There are a lot of parts of Georgia that are closer to Tallahassee than they are to Athens. And so, you know, I think the interesting thing there would be, you know, I do think you get a lot of kids from those areas that would rather go to an SEC school than an ACC school, just because of the, you know, sort of the hype and the, I guess the type of program that you would attend. And my joke with Florida State fans, though, is always that we have all the same rivals. So when you hate the same people, you know, it's easy to be friends. Enemy of my enemy is a friend of mine. And so I think it'd be interesting. I think we have a home and home with Florida State scheduled as well. So maybe they'll come in and the league will cancel that.
It's funny because the trend used to be get in, like this was the Florida State strategy, get in the ACC, steamroll your opponents, and then that sets you up for a national championship. But now the TV money is what's driving it. The age of NIL and being able to afford that, that it's no longer about getting to the game. It's just, it's funny how the economics of the sport have really, really changed.
Well, my favorite part is that, you know, they talk about adding all these teams. You know, did you see the ACC, that's the Atlantic Conference,
yes,
is adding Cal and Stanford. Now, I'm no geography expert, but I don't think that that's on the Atlantic coast. It's just, you know, it's one of those things where, like, I don't know what the Super League thing is going to, how it really benefits everybody, because, like, doesn't it seem like, even if you're Oklahoma or Texas, doesn't it seem like you'd be better to stay in the, you know, old Big Eight or whatever it is and dominate that league and get into the playoff than it does to join the SEC and, you know, maybe go 8-4 for a couple years?
Well, it just, there's no money in it, right? It's all about what you can make with a TV contract, and no one's tuning in to Rice versus Texas anymore, you know?
Except for there's a subset of Georgia fans that want to see JT Daniels do good at Rice. He's the only undefeated quarterback starter in Georgia history. He won 7 games as our starter, and now he's on to his fifth school. But I thought something funny, Jeff, when we talk about the money. I don't know about y'all, but up here in Montgomery, we have 2 internet providers or whatever, and 2 that are also cable providers. One is WOW, and the other one is Charter or Spectrum. And Spectrum viewers got a nice surprise when they tune in yesterday. So they say it's all about this TV money, and yet, you know, I can't even watch Florida get, you know, drummed out of Utah by the Utes.
Yeah, I saw a lot of complaints from my Montgomery follows on my Twitter timeline last night. All right. Hey, we conclude this segment's football portion on the politics. Dave, the 11th Circuit got to come out with their decision. I'm like the only believer here that they're going to just say, they're going to pit an incumbent against an incumbent, and they're going to draw a brand new congressional district that won't include Barry Moore, and it's going to be wide open in the newly constituted 2nd congressional district. But, I mean, do you have any premonitions about where this is headed? And we'll kind of go from there.
I don't necessarily, only because I think that all those things are just so, like, you know, up in the air or whatever. But to your point, like, pattern recognition can tell you that they sent it to the state in the first place. The reason that, you know, this got all the way up there and the way that they ruled was to have a district like you're talking about. I mean, we can talk about the sort of the, whether that's an intended or a second or third order effect, but effectively what the court said was you have to draw another, you know, you have to draw a separate sort of, you know, new, like you said, new district. And so then we didn't do that. And then they sent it, you know, we sent it back. And I think you're exactly right. I think that the most likely outcome is they go, you know what, this doesn't pass muster. We're going to draw this thing, and we're going to draw Moore and Carl into a district. Because I guess the reason for that is because they're the newest ones. I don't really, because the one thing that I will tell you this, Jeff, is that, you know, they say that it's about, you know, what like opportunity to vote, and but also communities of interest. And I don't know how drawing the Wiregrass and Mobile into the same district keeps communities of interest together. Do you?
No, but I will say this. If they do that, you can't draw a Mobile Wiregrass district without including Coffee County, right? Because the Coffee County is a big part of the Wiregrass. So if you're going to go in that direction, you're going to put Coffee County with Dothan. And that makes me think you're going to have Carl and Moore running against one another. And I'll tell you why I think this is something else that's on the radar here for them, is because they're both out running around each other's district or fundraising Jerry Carl did a big event in Enterprise last weekend, you know, and then Barry Moore has got a Jim Jordan fundraiser coming up in Montgomery next month. It's all these things that you see that I think are signs that they're both gearing up for what could be a very ugly, ugly primary.
Yeah, they both are definitely they're like girding their loins for that war, right? And I think you're exactly right. I think it's going to be very ugly because I think that both of those guys are very hard to get to the right of, you know, when you're talking about like how to position them to voters, and because it's going to be a very conservative district. You know, I think the question will probably come down to how much of it is in the Mobile media market versus how much of it is in the, you know, is in the Dothan or Montgomery media market. Because I think that, you know, Mobile, let's just face it, look, Mobile has more money. And so Carl probably has access to more direct campaign cash. But didn't the Club for Growth come after him last time?
They went big for Barry Moore, right?
Correct. And so I think that that's going to stay. And so then if you're Jerry Carl, you have to figure out, like, okay, how do you combat both of those things? And I believe that they endorsed his opponent last time, Bill Hightower. So he might have a little bit of, you know, knowledge in that arena. But, you know, that message is something that definitely resonated in the Wiregrass, I think, you know, a little bit better than in the other parts. So, I mean, I'd see it as super intriguing. The other question is if it's an opportunity, you know, it's an air quotes opportunity district. What does that look like in terms of African-American population, but also by like likely voter, you know what I mean? Because I'm of the contention that there's a number and it's probably higher than most people would think that like if it's 45 or under, is, you know, do they draw does the law of unforeseen consequences come in? They draw an opportunity district for a Democrat to win, and then a Republican wins it anyway.
Right, right. Well, here's the thing. This newly constituted hypothetical congressional district, we think Stephen Reed's going to run no matter what, right?
Yes.
Who would he run against if not Barry Moore? And the name that keeps coming up, and the guy who said that he was open to the idea, is Dick Brubaker. I might be the only guy that could beat Stephen Reed because you divide the Montgomery vote.
And, you know, I have a little experience with our former senator from Montgomery, Mr. Brubaker. And I remember running a poll with him in 2010 when he was looking to come, you know, he was in the state house, he retired or whatever, and then he came back as a senator. And the pollster asked me if we were positive about our data, you know, our poll books for the poll. And I said, you know, of course I am, da-da-da-da. And he goes, well, here's why I'm asking. I've been in this game for like 40 years, and I've never seen a politician for a candidate for a local office with higher numbers across the board than Dick Rubin.
Yeah. It's almost like it, even if it's a Selma, Montgomery, Troy sort of even throwing maybe a Phoenix City. I mean, Stephen Reed. Dave, I don't think Stephen Reed, while he won by a big margin in that mayoral contest, it wasn't that impressive to me. It's just he lost some ground from his first run.
Yeah, I think that, you know, but I think that the sort of the one thing that it did do is kind of cement in, I think, maybe voters or supporters or people that follow this mind is that, like, you know, his dad and that and the ADC organization are still a force to be reckoned with. And in a purely partisan race, it does a little bit more. But I also think that depending on, like you said, depending on where it is actually drawn, I don't think that he's going to get a free shot at a primary by any means. Now, I think he'll probably win a primary. But again, when you look at it, like, let's say that the number is like 45% by population, then you have to look at like likely voter turnout and stuff like that. I mean, I just don't know. You know, Brubaker is a pretty heavyweight who, you know, I think that maybe we overrate crossover appeal in a lot of things, but he definitely, you know, I don't know that voters, black voters, white voters, whoever, are going to clamor to vote against Dick Brubaker, if that makes sense. And so I think that that's a very, you know, interesting sort of, you know, what if? And the other crazy thing is the primary is like in March, and that's around the corner in politics. That's what, 6 months, 7 months from today?
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, they just, once this is in motion, then once the 11th circuit or whatever happens beyond that happens, whoever's going to run has got to go ahead and make up their mind, right?
Yes. I mean, they basically got to be ready to go, you know, when it comes down, or within several, you know, days or whatever. And, you know, I'm not totally sure. Do we have a timeline for when they'll actually, you know, rule?
No, we thought maybe last week, then for sure this week. And then I talked to Stacey a little earlier in the program, and he's like, well, I mean, there's still a few hours left in today that the decision could be handed down, but next week's not out of the realm of possibilities. It would make sense today because the shock or whatever happens would have a chance to subside, and Tuesday normal business gets back underway. But I think Wes Allen said he needs to have it by the very beginning of October in order to pull it off.
Because they also, there's a qualifying issue too, right? That, like, you know, you have to, you can't, I mean, they can do kind of whatever they want, I guess, ostensibly. I'm not sure that that's the, you know, we can argue about, you know, what is it, determinism or whatever, or you know, judicial review, all we want. But, like, ostensibly, you would need to have it before qualifying so that people know what district that they're actually running in, right? But it's not as if they truly care about what we do as long as we follow their orders, right?
Right, right. Hey, real quick, last question before we get you out of here. And we were talking about Stephen Reed. I mean, I think such a big part of it is the old Joe Reed machine, which is still a thing. I mean, get out the vote, and we can talk about how they do it and the questionable ethics behind it. But it matters. Is it still an apparatus that could win, or at least, is it Congress ready? It's definitely Montgomery mayoral race battle tested. Is this something that could work in a bigger sitting?
I think it's one of those things that, like, it's obviously an advantage, but I would think it's more an advantage in a Democratic primary. But I also think that, you know, what you'll probably see is a ton of super PAC money come in and sort of, you know, prop up that side of it. Instead of doing, you know, just ads or whatever, they'll actually sometimes run essentially like a voter contact, i.e., and you know, if I was smarter than I am, or on whatever side that is, I would be saying, hey, you know, form a super PAC now that can, you know, that can do that kind of work. Because that's the other thing, you know, the thing is that while they're still like a formidable organization, like you said, in Montgomery or whatever, you can reconstitute it by, you know, kind of like something that's dehydrated, right? You just pour water on it, or just pour money on it.
I like that that analogy. Dave, we got to get out of here. But we always appreciate getting you on. Hopefully, don't be a stranger. Let's get you on again soon.
Yeah, for sure. I would love to. Thank you, Jeff. And thanks for what you do, buddy.
Hey, you're the man, Dave. Dave Mowry, ladies and gentlemen. We got to get a break here, but we'll be right back. This is the Jeff Ford Show on FM Talk 106.5. Just glitter and shine. Welcome back to the Jeff Ford Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you for staying with us on this Friday morning, 251-343-0106. If you want to be in touch with the program. Let's see what we got here. Fire Dog. Right. It's an entire week without Dale Jackson. Whatever will I do? A horror and suffering. Wait, it's a holiday? Monday? Never mind, I'll be out on my boat fishing anyway. Stay safe out there, Fire Dog, but do appreciate it. Listen, we may or may not move him to you Tuesday. We'll see. We'll see what I can extract from Dale Jackson over the holiday weekend. Let's see. Jaybird College Pick'em. I need to do that. Speaking of, I need to make my college picks. I believe you could go to FM Talk 106.5 and find it, what you need to know, Jaybird, about that. I am told Dalton at FM Talk 106.5, if you have any questions about the college pick'em game here. I've been meaning to take part in this. So, yeah, if you go to our website, fmtalk1065.com, and you can look up at the top, the bar there, there's a blue bar. This is College Pick'em Challenge, and it basically tells you everything you need to know, what you can win, et cetera, and so on and so forth. So that's my public service announcement as far as that goes. Jaybird. So, I'm looking forward to joining that, making picks for 3 or 4 weeks, and then life taking shape and forgetting to put in my picks 1 week or whatever, and then playing catch up for the rest of the year. 251-343-0106. Let us know what's on your mind, what you're thinking. We're wide open the next couple of segments, so now's your chance to get in. Got to get a break in here now, though. This is the Jeff Moore Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Muddy water, Mississippi, blessed Graceland whispers to me. Carry on, sweet southern comfort, carry on.
Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
No. Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for staying with us on this Friday, first day of September, Rabbit morning. 251-343-0106. You want to be in touch with the program, utilize the text line, and we'll do our best to respond to any of your texts. But wide open here for the next couple of segments. So to come about a half hour from now, we close out the week, as we do every week, with our returning champion, State Senator Chris Elliott. A lot of you probably still reeling from the toll increase on the Beach Express down in South Baldwin County. Those who use that route, and it went up from $1.80 something to $5. So you gotta feel it there. That's a tough place to be. But one of the local officials, including Mayor Kennan of Orange Beach, nobody to blame but the governor and the ALDOT director, who I can't really figure out, how does he still have a job, by the way? Can somebody just tell me that? That's a perpetual question on this program we will ask every single day until we find out. Somebody give me a straightforward answer. And the ALDOT director, the lead bureaucrat of transportation policy. Yesterday, Ivy had a big announcement in Birmingham, if you haven't heard. And she announced three Birmingham projects, $500 million, $300 million going toward widening 65 in Shelby County, South Shelby County. An intersection at I-59 near Trussville. A bunch of different things going on in Birmingham with regards to transportation policy. But anyway, I guess the point being is this: it is no John Cooper, no John Cooper at the event yesterday. What does that tell us? Anything? Anything we need to know about what's going on there is the question. And I just you wonder if he's, this is an agency where Cooper's sort of the front man, but maybe it's a bureaucracy that runs itself. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But it's very peculiar the way this is unfolding there in Montgomery. Let's go to the text line. Unnamed texter. There's a DEI committee at the University of South Alabama. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding about the University of South Alabama is that it has a its DEI situation is much much more low key, I guess. It's not as all consuming as at the other schools in Alabama. That is what a couple lawmakers told me, and the reason I know this, when they were going to strip that funding away from the Department of Archives and History, they were going to and Sarah Elliott was going to give it to South Alabama because they haven't allowed the DEI bureaucrats to play such a big role. So as much if that is true, I haven't really looked into it myself. We tried. But if that is true, a rare moment of clarity for the University of South Alabama, in my book at least. I know some of y'all think, well, why are you always beat up on South? But former college newspaper editor at South, a South graduate, my experience at South was tainted by politics and the politics of the faculty there at the time. But that's what my understanding about this DEI situation at University of South Alabama is. A texter asked him how we ban 3D meat. What the hell is 3D meat? Hey, this meat is being grown in a lab setting, and they're doing it in the name of like climate responsibility or whatever? No. Get that stuff out of here. I don't want that anywhere near me. Am I the only one that is terrified by the possibility of lab grown meat? Yeah, I want nothing to do with that stuff. Ricky, this is your chance. When you take a break from all your worldly concerns, then we need to team up here and stop our government from trying to feed us lab-produced meat. That's something I have nothing to do with. That stuff is just icky. 251-343-0106. Need to be in touch with the program. Keep them coming. Dirt Digger says the ALDOT director must have dirt on Meemaw Ivy and covering for her on the 43 project. Yeah, that's a big part of it. Here's what's going on with the 43 project, at least as far as the governor is concerned. Kay Ivey wants this project really bad. I don't know why. People say it's because of her Black Belt roots and her being from Camden and Wilcox County. But if you look at the map and where the 43 project's going to go, it's not really anywhere near Wilcox County. I mean, back me up on this. Thomasville, and then if you want to go to Wilcox County, you could hop on 5 and get a part of Wilcox County. But the route is going to be the other direction, away from Wilcox County, more Marengo County, more Hale County, and then on in Tuscaloosa. Maybe she wants to be the Republican governor that didn't forget about the Black Belt. That's all fine and dandy. But I don't know whatever her justification is. It's strange. But she really wants this project done. This is going to be her legacy. She's going to be the governor that remembered the black belt. And it's a big, big gamble. Now, 20 years from now, you know, if I'm still around and I'm pontificating with my, you know, very pedestrian view of Alabama politics, and I look back and, wow, the black belt really has blossomed in the last 20 years. And thank God for Governor Ivey. She had the vision that I didn't have. I don't think I'm going to be saying that. She had the vision that I that no one else had to build a four-lane road out in the middle of nowhere. And now it is a thriving, economically viable part of the state that everybody wants to live. It's the new Huntsville. If that's where we are 20 years because of this, then that's her legacy. Demopolis is the new Huntsville in 20, 30 years. She'll be exonerated. Anybody buying that? No, but this is it. Cooper is sort of the central figure here. He keeps everything together and gives the governor what she wants. And I think that's why she's so beholden to him. Because if you bring in a new ODOT director, we don't know what that might, where that might take us, what that might look like, do we? What would they possibly, how could they possibly, anybody with any kind of ethics or morals or whatever, scruples, and say, hey, we should keep doing this project because it's such a good idea, Governor. Who would say that other than John Cooper? And maybe that's why he holds on to his job, is all I can figure. Ricky writes, Ricky, this is not what I asked for. I'm trying to give you an active role here. Unnamed texter, it's so Meemaw can zip up 43 to Tuscaloosa to watch the game. Well, no, because she's in Montgomery or wherever she is, even if she's at her lake house a lot. The deal with that is, guys, Governor Ivey, I guess if she really wanted a four-lane road to go watch Bama play. Now, she's an Auburn grad. And if you look, there is a video on Governor Ivey's social media of her playing the trumpet. She's playing the Auburn fight song. So I think Governor Ivey and I have a comment. We're both Auburn University marching band alums. She's playing the fight song on social media. She's going to want to zip over to Auburn probably more than likely. But if she weren't really that were her concern, Highway 82, which is the road that travels between Montgomery and Tuscaloosa, it's a two-lane rickety road. It should have been four-lane. All these roads should have been four lanes years and years ago, but they built the Tom Bigby Waterway or whatever, and all these other transportation priorities took precedent. And let's face it, guys, the Alabama Department of Transportation, over the years, it's about like our governor situation. It's been pretty rocky. But none of the big roads got done. Let's see. What do we have here? Pat, if I had to guess, I'd assume the University of Alabama had a lot to do with this 4-lane 43. What surprised me is she got some hush money to build it. No, that's, I don't know about the hush money part, but hey, it's possible the University of Alabama, you know, we don't think about this. When we talk about the big mules, what am I talking about? Then these are these big, powerful corporations in Alabama politics, or they play in Alabama politics. Blue Cross, Blue Shield, Regions Bank, Alabama Power. Sounds like the Auburn halftime show sponsors, maybe with the exception of like Sister Schubert's rolls and Golden Flake potato chips or something. But anyway, those are the big mules, and they dictate about a lot. And then one of those, the new one now is the universities. Auburn and Alabama have a very, very big sway about what goes on in Montgomery at the executive level and at the legislative level. But I don't know. The University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, at least, doesn't consider itself a state university. They think of themselves as a national university now because so many out-of-state students want to go there. A named texture. I have a good authority that the Mobile Red Elephant Club is the force behind the West Alabama corridor. What are you going to do, though? I mean, you can't stop in Fonsdale anymore. The tornado got Fonsdale Bar and Grill. Can't go the old way. You know, pop into the Thomasville Walmart there. I don't know, what do you do? What are the sights you go see between Mobile and Tuscaloosa? Those of you, that is football season, and that's a route you travel. Or do some of you just go up through Mississippi, I bet, and get on the interstate near Meridian and go on in probably the fastest way. Anyway, enough of that. Let's get a break in here. This is the Jeff Porter Show on FM Talk 106.5.
Curtis Snow was the finest pickup to ever play the blues. I saw the light, I saw the light. No more darkness, no more night. Now I'm so happy, no sorrow inside. Praise the Lord, I saw the light.
Welcome back to the Jeff Porter Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for staying with us on this Friday. Get out of town before the holidays, Labor Day weekend. We do appreciate it. A quick programming note, as I said earlier, no show on Monday, best of or worst of, I don't know. Is there really a best of Jeff Porter Show? That's up for you to decide. But Tuesday when we get back, we do have one guest booked, the Speaker of the House, so Nathaniel Ledbetter, going to join the program. We'll talk some, we'll talk about obviously, a lot of things on people's mind, but I anticipate the gambling discussion with Speaker Ledbetter. I think gambling next year will be the year for gambling if it's going to happen. The Speaker paneled an ad hoc committee in the House of Representatives to look at the gambling issue. We've been down this road before. We know how this movie ends. It starts in the Senate, and then it gets through the Senate by some miracle, and then the House doesn't even bother with it. And just talking to Senator Albritton about it, and he, despite numerous efforts, says, "Well, maybe either we need to go with the House needs to go first, and then we can try to work with it." What happens, guys, and this may be by design, these guys spend all session trying to get a 3/5 majority. Why do you need a 3/5 majority? Because that's what it takes to get on the ballot for a constitutional amendment. You need a constitutional amendment to remove the prohibition on gambling if you just want a lottery. But if you remove that prohibition, what does that open up? Because you have the Porch Creek Indians who are governed by federal law. And then could they expand their gaming on tribal land from games of skill to games of chance? That's the question. So all of that is always weighing in on Alabama's yearly gambling discussion. But you got to come up with the votes. And a lot of times they spend the entire session trying to come up with the votes to get it to the ballot. And you get through one chamber, then the other chamber has radically different ideas about how it should be done. And that's where the problem lies, is finding, how do you find consensus from 140 lawmakers in the state house? Leo, lab grown meat equals Soylent Green. And I don't know that I'm quite there, but yeah, that live-grown meat scares the hell out of me. Monty, when I go through Fonsdale to Greensboro to Marion, I do it because I am mesmerized by the grooved asphalt roads and catfish ponds. Well, Monty, you know why those roads are grooved? It's all those logging trucks, right? All those trucks, all that truck traffic. up and down 25 and 69. And I think that has a lot to do with why Governor Ivey is looking to build that four-lane road. Maybe it's this. It seems like a handout to Big Ag or to forestry or whatever. I mean, that's very possible. But in the same time, maybe she'll be able to preserve some of those state roads that you and I are familiar with. The Fonsdale was always, they had the Fonsdale Crawfish Festival. Those of you at the University of Alabama may remember that. Scott Butcherman and I talked about that on one of our shows not long ago, how they would have the A-Day game in Alabama and then everybody leave at halftime to go down to Fonsdale from Tuscaloosa to go to that. And that was the big thing. But the Bar and Grill there, kind of an institution. I went to it maybe 3-4 years ago, and it's got one of those old wood-burning stoves in the middle, and the food's pretty decent. It used to be a rowdy, rowdy place, but it's became more of a boutique-y, or I don't know, what would you call it, a high-end dining for whatever you would call high-end dining in that part of Marengo County. But that's what they tried to do, and then that tornado got it a couple of years ago. Adam! Meemaw's Highway is as misguided and stupid as the Amtrak deal. No, I do think it's a misguided, but nothing's as dumb as that Amtrak deal. But thanks for the text, Adam. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Moore Show on FM Talk 106.5.
When the dealing's done, every gambler knows